everyone. Welcome back to the Middle Game Podcast. This is episode 2. We're really excited to have you back. Lula, do you want to kick us off today for our episode?
I would love to, because I actually, when I was editing our last episode, I realized that I didn't introduce myself. And even though our like 3 listeners probably already know who I am, I just thought that in case anybody had the misfortune to stumble across this podcast without knowing who we are, I should probably introduce myself. So hi, I'm Lula. I live in Paris. I'm a chess content creator. I'm 26. And that's still very young. Just for those of you who were wondering, it's still really very young. And it gives me lots of time to accomplish things in my life.
It does. Should I reintroduce myself? Or do we think my introduction last episode was sufficient? Hi, I'm Amelia. I'm 25. It feels weird saying that.
So young.
And I am an American girl living in Vienna. I moved here like 3 years ago, and I'm now getting my PhD in Soviet chess history. I wouldn't say I'm a chess content creator. More so, I just maybe comment a lot on chess, especially with my PhD work. So, yeah.
That's cool. I would say that you're like a chess observer.
Yeah, that's what I said last time.
Oh, shit. I'm plagiarizing. Okay. I would say you're like a chess oracle.
Oh, I like that. A chess oracle?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're like the chess oracle. Especially because whenever I ask you something, you're like, yeah, in 1965, FIDE did this, and now that's why something is the way that it is. And then I'm like, wow, I learned something.
Oh, cool. Okay. I like that. Chess oracle. I'm going to put that in my Twitter bio.
You should do that. Even though Twitter is dead and it sucks now.
That is true. It does really suck. Yeah. But
I tweeted something yesterday for the first time in a while, and it got like fewer than 1,000 views, which is insane because I have like more than 30,000 followers. And it's just basically because, okay, I'm not super active anymore, but it's just because Elon fucked it up, right?
Yeah.
If you don't pay, then you don't get views.
Yeah. It's really sad. You haven't been tweeting much lately anyway, though.
I made a conscious choice to stop engaging on X because I think it's an evil platform. And I just tweeted a cat picture. That was it. It wasn't super deep, but it reminded me why I stopped tweeting in the first place.
Yeah, I've been considering stopping tweeting and like just stopping being on social media altogether. A few years ago, actually, I deleted my Facebook, which was honestly the best thing I've ever done for my mental health. Because then after that, I was just like, people on the internet, like, I don't care about their opinions. Like, I can just go and delete Facebook and none of these opinions like actually matter in my real life. And so I've been thinking about doing that with X, especially because there are a lot of things on there that make me sad and depressed. So like one of those things was I saw the other day that Boris Spassky died. RIP.
Yeah, I saw that. Rest in peace, Boris Spassky. I think that Boris Spassky is like such an underrated chess player, not in like an ELO sense, but in the sense that like, actually, if he hadn't been such a nice person, Bobby Fischer would never have been world chess champion, because that is without Boris Spassky just being like, yeah, okay, we can play in this stupid room on these stupid chairs without any cameras. Like, they would have just disqualified Bobby Fischer. Bobby Fischer would have never been world chess champion, and the history of chess would have been fundamentally changed. So Boris Spassky, all-around good guy.
That is so true. All-around good guy. And also, too, I think it's really crazy that he was so patient with Bobby Fischer, and just the way that he just patiently waited, you know, for him to arrive in Iceland. And especially too, I mean, Bobby Fischer in and of himself is obviously a problematic character, especially towards the end of his life. But I do think it's really hilarious the way that he did offer for Boris to have his special chair. It was like the special leather chair that he wanted for the tournament. And he was like, Boris, do you want one too? And Boris was like, no, thanks. I don't need that.
That's nice. I feel like the thing that I always go back to is Boris saying that he wanted to win in the right way. If he was going to win, he didn't want to win by default, essentially. Yeah. And I think that there's a lot of honor in that.
I do think that there's a lot of honor in that too. And I think that it's really great to have him be so remembered. I saw this picture of David Yada with him, and I also saw like a picture of David Howell with him as well. And he was just like such a integrated part of the chess community as well. So I hope that he rests in peace. We lost a legend. And speaking of legends,
Speaking of legends,
we also lost
rest in peace, Michelle Trachtenberg.
RIP. Georgina was fundamental in my upbringing as a young woman. And also Ice Princess, absolute iconic
Ice
movie.
Princess was huge. Ice Princess was one of the first live action movies I watched as a kid that I felt was made for me. And I feel like there is not a lot of media that's made for young girls that tries to engage them in a serious way, you know? And like the takeaway from that movie was that you can be smart and you can succeed academically, but you can also follow like non-academic passions, and that doesn't take away from your intelligence. And that was something that wasn't like being represented in my media that I was consuming as a young girl. So
Especially too, I think it's one of the first examples where we see like a woman in STEM in a way, like being represented in kind of like mainstream media. And I think, I mean, I personally am not a woman in STEM. I'm a woman in the humanities, but I think still that's really important, especially nowadays with kind of the male dominance of STEM. It's just like one of those movies too that gives you that heartwarming feeling like when she succeeds. And I think she was so good in that, and really, in like almost all the roles she played. I'll be honest, I only ever really saw her in that in Gossip Girl, but.
okay, she was so good in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, this is one of my favorite shows of all time. I rewatch it. She's so good in it. And she's so young as well, but she is such an amazing actress. I have to say, I didn't watch the whole of Gossip Girl, so I didn't see her as Georgina much. But yeah, she was amazing in Buffy too.
It's also really sad too, because I know that she struggled a lot, I think, with alcoholism, like throughout her life. And I know that I think the reason why she died is because she got a liver transplant and like there were complications with that. And
Yeah,
so,
that's what I saw.
yeah, and so it's just really sad too. She was so young. I feel like she's, besides
Yeah.
Liam Payne, she's one of like the first people of our generation who grew up in the media to like have passed away.
Yeah, and it feels scary. It makes you come to terms with your mortality. I saw that she had been like a huge philanthropist as she was getting older and actually coming into a place where she was financially independent, because a lot of child stars obviously don't have access to their money that they've made until they're adults. And I saw that she had just donated, you know, millions and millions to women, and to like, she wasn't just making money and spending it, you know, she was actually doing something with it, which is nice to see.
It is really nice to see. I think that a lot of the times, especially actors and high profile actors, they don't necessarily put their money where their mouth is. And so it's nice to see when people actually, say, oh, XYZ is a problem, but I'm actually going to do something to fix it.
I just wanted to go back to you deleting your Facebook, slightly off topic now. I tried to delete my Facebook last week, and then I found out that there are like two fake Lularobs profiles on Facebook. So I had to reactivate my personal Facebook to try and like report them to take them down. And they're still there, and they have like five followers, and they're just stealing my content, and it sucks.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
And you reported them and everything?
Yeah, and Facebook just didn't reply. I was like, yeah, this is fraud. They're pretending to be me. And there's two of them. So, like, obviously, you know, something's up. And yeah, I don't know. I didn't even know they were there until somebody told me.
That's really weird. I don't
Right?
understand. I honestly have never understood kind of this whole culture around creating, I mean, obviously people do it to scam other people, and that's one thing, but also I don't understand it necessarily from the sense of like just doing it to impersonate. Like, I think that's just some mental illness that I just don't understand.
Especially because I'm not even famous. So like I would get it. I get the
You're kind of
people who
famous.
No,
You're a
I get the
micro
people who have
influencer for sure. For sure.
Wow. Wow, micro influencer. But yeah, I feel like people who have malicious intentions do this with celebrities, and I also understand people making fan pages if they explicitly state that it's a fan page. But like I don't even know who who takes a random chess streamer's stuff and then re-uploads it as their own? It's weird. It's very niche and strange.
It is. And also too, like the fan pages I get. I will admit, I did run a 5 Seconds of Summer fan page as a kid. And like fan pages are just like fun ways for people to interact with each other who like the same thing. But like again, you have to make explicitly clear that it is a fan page.
Yeah,
But people who
exactly.
do this
I
and
can't
are
believe you
like,
did that.
I was a Tumblr five sauce fan
Me
page
too.
girly.
I was a Tumblr girly, but I was on a different part of Tumblr. I got called into school and they told me to take my Tumblr page down. So I don't
Wait,
think we were.
why?
Well, this is a story for another time, but I don't think we were on the same side of Tumblr.
Okay, this is
Yeah.
fascinating. So I guess
Anyway.
people will have to stay tuned into our podcast to find out why you had to get your Tumblr page taken down.
Yeah, it was a big deal. I was like 14, so it was
Wow.
the trenches.
Honestly, 14 is it's a hard age for sure.
I am so glad I'm not a teenager anymore. I was worried, I have like one gray hair that I pick out every time it grows back, and I was worried that I'm getting old. But then I just remember, like, I would never ever want to be a teenager again.
Yeah, neither do I. Honestly, I hated high school. I maybe hated is a strong word. I didn't hate high school, but it definitely was not the time of my life. You know, there are people who are like, "Wow, high school, it was the best time of my life." Like, you know,
No,
peak.
no way.
I did not peak in high school, and I'm so thankful for it.
If you peak in school, like what do you do for the rest of your life?
Right?
Like what do you do now?
No idea.
Anyway, Amelia, I heard that you have some very spicy chess gossip this week for me.
Oh, I have chess gossip? I heard you have chess gossip. Or do we have chess
Okay.
gossip?
We both collectively have different chess gossips.
True.
But I'm happy to start if you want to. I met up with my friend Mackenzie yesterday, and she told me she was thinking of playing Grenke, which is this really big tournament in Germany that I think Dodgy played like last year or something. And this year, Grenke have this agreement with Freestyle Chess to run a freestyle tournament alongside the classical chess tournament. And because freestyle chess is run by a really rich man, the prize fund is way bigger. And so everyone who's good at chess is signing up. Like all of the top players are signing up to play the freestyle instead of the open. And this feels like a big deal. Like this feels kind of like a culture shift.
So, I would like to premise this with I like freestyle chess. I think it's interesting. I'm not against this whole freestyle chess movement, but what makes me sad is when we kind of disproportionately like pit it against like classical chess, for example. Like, I would have loved to see the freestyle chess people maybe, yes, have a prize fund that's a bit bigger than, you know, the open one, but then say, you know, like we still want to support classical chess, like we'll match the open's prize fund so that it can be as much as the freestyle one. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that would be a nice world with like puppies and rainbows, but I don't think it would happen because no one actually wants to play freestyle chess. Like, I love Chess 960, and I'm going to call it Chess 960 because that's what it is. And, or Fischer Random, like, these are the two terms that I recognize. And I love it. Okay, I love playing Fischer Random. Every week on my stream, I run a Fischer Random tournament with my community, and they hate it. Like, they push back so much because they're afraid. Like, if you speak to the majority of chess players, They are so reliant on their openings. They're so reliant on their pattern recognition that when they start to play freestyle or chess 960 or whatever you want to call it, they instantly drop like 500 ELO because they don't know what they're doing because they've never played based on vibes before. And that's what chess is. Like in freestyle chess, you have to just play based on the vibes. So I personally love it. I think it's super challenging. But I think if you gave equal prize funds for the open and the freestyle open, everyone would just play the normal open because there has to be some incentive to play freestyle chess. I think for super grandmasters, it's slightly different, right? Because they're so tired. They're so, so tired of theory and they're so tired of learning like 30 moves of prep just to get like a slight edge. So I get that there's incentive for them to play freestyle, but for the average chess player or even the average like international master, like regular grandmaster who's not a super grandmaster, these people are almost always going to be choosing normal classical chess. So I don't think that you can put the two variants on an equal footing and expect an equal number of players to sign up for each.
I just don't know how to fix the problem. Then I think of like, because people are like, oh, classical chess, it's so boring. Like, is, you know, it's dying. People want rapid. People want blitz. I personally don't think that's true. I believe in my heart of hearts that classical chess is the superior form of chess. I hate blitz. Rapid is okay. I will play rapid. Obviously, I think rapid is good too, like when you're training for tournaments. But classical chess is where it's at. I love seeing commentators run analysis of, you know, multiple different lines. And also too, I think the physical pressure of playing classical chess and sitting there for hours on end is just something that is so raw and beautiful that I don't know how, I don't understand like why people are saying, oh, classical chess is dying. Like, we need to fix it. We need to do something else. We need chess 960. So I don't know. Do you think classical chess is dying?
I love classical chess. It's like one of the only forms of chess that I'm willing to play. The other being like shorter time controls of chess 960. I think that all of the grandmasters, when you see the interviews with them, they all have such different takes on which is their favorite time control. And I think that because the chess world is so Magnus-centric, for lack of a better term, when we hear Magnus say that he's sick and tired of playing classical chess, and he has said this in a lot of interviews, we think that this is like the representative idea of the masses. And it's honestly just not. Like, Magnus is probably the most powerful individual in chess because, you know, he's considered to be by many the greatest chess player of all time. That doesn't make his word law, and it doesn't mean that everybody agrees with him. Just because Magnus doesn't want to play long classical games doesn't mean that other people don't. And I think that long classical games are what made a lot of people fall in love with chess in the first place. That's definitely the case for me, because I think that that's where a lot of the beauty in chess lies, is in the richness, like you say, of the analysis, of the endless possibilities, of the variations. And you don't get this depth of analysis or a depth of thought in something like blitz.
Mm-hmm. I think too, it makes me really sad just the power that Magnus has over kind of the entire chess community and this influence that he has. You know, I think he's a really important player. I've watched his games really intently for the past almost 3 years now, and you know, he's a fantastic chess player, but there's more to chess than just Magnus, and I wish that everyone, especially, I really think maybe this is honestly just kind of an online chess thing, but I really wish that everyone would see that and that we would have kind of a greater communal kind of bond in chess to fight against this, you know, Magnus not wanting to play long classical games anymore.
I totally agree about it being an online thing. It feels like because so many people are always joining the online chess world, like you have so many more people in online chess than in real life chess, is that they only are able to interact with these very few chess players, right? So they see Magnus, they see Hikaru. If they're really into content, maybe they see the Botas sisters, but if not, they don't really know any of the other top chess players. Maybe they know Hans because of controversies, but a lot of them don't know who like Lavon Aronian is or like Shakhriyar Mamajarov. And these are really, really strong, really famous chess players. It feels kind of like in Hollywood how they cast like the three same actors in every single movie. And it's just because you're being fed these three people. These are the only people whose opinions you're going to think matter and the only people who you're going to actually have meaningful interaction with when it comes to their chess games or their opinions.
Can I say something controversial that might have to be edited yes. out depending on what Dodgy says about it?
Yes.
I think that Magnus needs to be more responsible with what he says, especially when it comes to being inclusive about the chess community and welcoming other, not only just like the people around him. Like, for example, we've talked about this a lot, the way that freestyle chess is almost just another way to exclude women from chess, because mm-hmm. yes, they're having this freestyle chess open tournament, but the only people that we have seen so far in freestyle chess is Magnus and all the guys that he decides to invite to his freestyle chess tournament.
Magnus and the five men he agrees to play chess against.
Right? And it's like, come on, dude. Like, you are world chess champion. You know that what you say matters. And I'm sorry, but you have to accept that responsibility.
I totally agree with that. I did see something recently about how Mr. Freestyle, like, I don't know his name, how Mr.
Jan
Freestyle...
Jan-Henrik Buter. I think that's his
yeah,
name.
Mr. Freestyle, how he wanted to invite Hans to something. And he basically said that Magnus had no say in who was invited. But I think that this must be some kind of new change. Or like Magnus must have been consulted for at least the first run last year. Because otherwise, if you're Mr. Freestyle and you're not really into chess, like how do you know who you're choosing, right? Because there are a lot of very, very strong chess players. So there's got to be some executive decisions made. I don't know if there was like a specific qualification process that they used. I don't think that was really publicized.
Yeah, I don't know. But the thing about this is that it bleeds into other things that they are doing. Like, for example, when Mr. Freestyle and Magnus and all of them like released that press statement saying that, you know, they're going to start an independent organization to represent like these top chess players with a legal team so that they can have protection, I guess, against FIDE. When you think a bit deeper about that situation, where they were when they were making these decisions and having these conversations, it was at Freestyle Chess, whatever, at Waisenhaus. And the only people that were there were Magnus, the five dudes he agrees to play against, and Mr. Freestyle. And it's like, where are the women? Where are the women?
It's such an echo chamber, right?
Yeah.
I'm working on a video essay at the moment about like clothing and chess and dress codes and stuff. And there was this thing in 2017, which people call shortsgate. And basically where a grandmaster was essentially, he ended up leaving a tournament over his clothing and the ACP responded. And their statement they made was very emotive. Like it wasn't.
Hello, everyone. This is Amelia editing. And just want to point out here that the ACP stands for the Association of Chess Professionals. It was dissolved in 2023. So it no longer exists. But that's what we're talking about. Anyway, back to the episode.
The kind of statement that like a lawyer would let you publish. You know, mm-hmm. it was very emotive. And I get that because they're deeply invested. But it does make sense to me that they weren't super effective because it didn't feel professional.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I think that, at least from my perspective, and as someone who's started in organization... Oh, I should say this. I should have said this in my introduction. But for those who don't know, I also am the president of the Women in Chess Foundation. I run it with Mr. Dodgy, who is my co-founder, and he's the chairman of the board of directors. But essentially, like, yes, in a way, I am a chess person, but also I'm not, because I didn't start playing in tournaments until literally this year. And I've known how to play for a really long time, but I was never a part of the chess community. And so my background, honestly, is in political science, foreign policy, just like public policy in general. My mom, she works at a nonprofit. She has her whole life. And so you really, I think, need someone from the outside coming in to set up these institutions in chess to make them run well and efficiently. Not that I don't think chess players can do it, but it's really hard, I think, when you have a foot in both doors, because I think it's really difficult for you to kind of have that objective nature that you need to have in order to like run a big organization like the ACP. Like it doesn't work unless you have someone who's dedicating all of their time to making that organization run.
Yeah, and I guess this is where Mr. Freestyle comes in, right? He's the outside person.
Yeah, and I think that's great. Like, I think he is really shaking things up in chess. I really appreciate, you know, how he's stood up to FIDE, but also at the same time, there needs to be a bit of knowledge. You need to learn a bit about chess and its community and how it functions, and not just rely on Magnus, who is the top chess player, yes, but he doesn't represent the entire chess community, you know? And so I commend him for what he's doing. I think he's doing something really interesting, but I think that I just would love to see different voices in there and see more women represented, more, you know, people of color. I mean, I know that's an ongoing battle in the chess world anyway, but I just think that there are more people in the chess world. So maybe we should move on to a little less crazy chess gossip.
Actually, the most important thing I wanted to talk about today was that I had a really creepy dream last night.
Okay. Tell me about your dream.
Okay, so I had this dream that I was like in this house, and then these evil people came in, and it's kind of fuzzy, right? Because it's a dream. And these evil people came in, and for some reason they let me go, but they took like my, I don't know if it was like my friends or my family, but it was people who I cared about very much. And they put them in the basement in like this hole. And I remember there was like this really thick concrete floor, and you could see through a hole going down into the basement, and you knew bad things were happening there. And then for some reason I went away, and then I came back, and the evil people were throwing a party in this house. But it was all evil people at the party. When I say evil, I mean really evil. You know, they're kidnapping people and putting them in the basement kind of evil. And I came back, and like there was obviously this feeling that it was a big mistake to come back, because they had let me go, and if I came back they would probably put me in the basement as well. But I felt this horrible sense of guilt that if I didn't come back to help the people I loved, that I would be responsible for bad things happening to them as well. And like the dream ended with me like looking down into the hole and like not knowing what my fate would be. So I don't know what that says.
As chess oracle, I wonder if it's a dream that is telling you that maybe you're a bit worried about the future. Like you don't know what's gonna happen, and so
this is maybe true. You're just like subconsciously my partner afraid. And I were talking about World War III yesterday. So
yeah, I'm worried about World War III.
Yeah, so maybe this was like a little thing my brain was saying about my worries about World War III. I don't know. That was my whole night's sleep. Because you know when you only remember one dream, and it felt like that dream, even though that dream probably lasted like 3 minutes, It felt like that spanned the entire course of the night, right? Because it's all you remember. And so it's like, oh, great. That's the night's sleep I had last night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry you had a bad dream.
That's okay. I have a lot of bad dreams. Like the dreams I have are either so basic and normal that I'm not sure if they were real life or not. Mm-hmm. Or they're horrific. Like, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if that's normal. Do you have those?
No, I don't. I can't remember when I, like, last had a crazy dream, honestly. I have a lot of dreams where I'm in plane crashes. So I don't know what that says about me. But I have had, I think, this year I've had 3 dreams related to plane crashes, so
I think that's valid, though, because planes are crashing more now than, like, ever in our lifetimes. So I think that's an understandable worry that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like in better news, I have developed a hyperfixation with Skyr, which is like that yogurt that they make.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know. Okay, because I live in France, so when you go to the supermarket, there's a whole aisle of yogurt. Like, not in an America way where there's like loads of different brands, in the kind of way where like there's like 50 different types of yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have Greek yogurt, you have regular yogurt, you have fromage blanc, you have like 5,000 different types of yogurt, and none of them make sense to me. But Skyr is now like my new yogurt of choice. And also it has such high protein. And because I've been trying to eat more protein in like a normal way, not in like a creepy eat five chicken breasts raw kind of way, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not that I
am
kind of way.
I actually am also obsessed with Skyr. I put Skyr in everything. Yeah. In my
It's
oats.
Good, right? And they make flavored Skyr as well. My favorite is lemon cheesecake.
Ooh. I've only seen strawberry and I think like blueberry at the supermarket here. But okay. We don't have a
this
lot
is
of
the
yogurt
cultural
here
difference
in Austria.
Between Austria and France, right? Yeah. Because we have lemon cheesecake and you have strawberry. Like that must say something about our two cities. So I know that maybe, Amelia, you're not a yogurt expert, but you are like a chess history expert. And I know that you're working on your PhD right now. Our group chat has been full of you talking about this like 15 kilogram FIDE history book. And I was just wondering how things are going with the research.
Actually, I had quite a big exam last week for my PhD. So for those who don't know, I'm currently getting my PhD in comparative history, and my dissertation is going to be on the International Chess Federation. I'm essentially writing an institutional history of FIDE, and my main thesis is essentially that in the 70s and 80s and 90s, FIDE transformed from a chess institution to a diplomatic institution. And so I'm kind of just exploring that. And with that, kind of the history of Soviet chess and how Soviet and Russian foreign policy have interacted with FIDE as an international sports organization. I did have a fun historical committee meeting yesterday. I am also on the FIDE Historical Committee, and we had some fun proposals that were being proposed. One of them was about the World Chess Championships and like the Olympiads and how. So one thing about FIDE is that in the late 90s, early 2000s, the original FIDE archives, which had kind of the original archives of the FIDE administration, so from like Alexander Rube to Folke Rogard to Kampomones, like all of those like presidential and administrative documents got sold to this archive in the Netherlands. That is where it now lives. But now FIDE has it's rebuilding its own archive because when you donate something to an archive, it is very rare that they will give it back to the original institution because of just the importance of archival practices and making sure that these documents are stored properly. So FIDE was like, whatever. And so they're restarting their own archive. And so for one of these proposals, like they want to keep the original of all the score sheets, and they want it to be like in the FIDE statutes that the organizing committee is required to make a replica of the, for example, like the World Chess Championship medal and trophy to keep like in the FIDE archives, which is very interesting. I don't know how organizations are going to like that. And so it's just was a fun historical committee meeting. I'm the only woman on the historical committee, and all the old guys there are really sweet, but it is really interesting to like sit there and listen to them talk about chess history. But yeah, that was really eventful yesterday, you know, having them argue for or against this. And then as well, another really interesting proposal
can I stop you? Because I have multiple questions.
Okay, yes.
Okay. So my first question is that, is there a conflict of interest with you doing your PhD about FIDE, but also being a member of a FIDE commission?
That's a really good question. I've thought about this very deeply, and the answer really is no, because yes, I'm on this FIDE historical committee, but also at the same time, like, none of what we talk about is directly related to my dissertation. And also, if you read my master's dissertation, it's very clear that, like, I'm not pro FIDE, I
You're not a
guess.
FIDE plant.
I'm not a FIDE plant. I do try my best to take an objective. I mean, you can't ever be 100% objective, but like, it's very clear that like I'm not writing like that FIDE is perfect, and so it's not a huge conflict of interest. Also, like, I don't do much really for the historical committee anymore. Like, I go to meetings and I really just sit and listen, and that's about it. But that is a good question.
Thank you. I have more questions. My follow-up question about the archive is that not absolutely insane to just donate all of your organization's original materials to some random museum? Like, why would you do that? Why would you not keep the originals for your own records, for your ongoing organization? It's not like FIDE was dissolved.
Apparently, like, some guy died who was like in charge of it, and then okay, the thing about the FIDE archives, let me put an asterisk on this. It is just a bunch of documents in one guy's house. Like, this is not like a professional facility. So when I say FIDE archives, really just think like some guy's basement.
This makes so much sense for FIDE. Like, I'm starting to understand how FIDE runs.
Yes, and so when this previous guy died, I think his family didn't realize like that this was the FIDE archives, and so they sold it to this archive in the Netherlands. And now we're doing it again. I have been asking FIDE to actually create a climate-controlled archival facility, but they
That's a
are
good idea.
stingy. Yeah,
But
I'm
they can
like,
afford it.
well, the thing is, they have offices in Switzerland. Like, they could just have it all there. I don't understand why they can't just, like, give me a room with some shelves. Like, I'll organize it. But they won't do it. So it's all in this one guy's house who's on the historical committee. And I will say he does take very good care of it. He's very passionate about chess history, and I do believe it's safe there, but like,
But
all of
FIDE
this
is like a
stuff
whole
needs.
governing body for a major international sport. This is like if FIFA had, like, I don't know, all of their footballs in some random guy's basement. I don't know. They would be weird. Like, no one would do that, you know?
Yeah, and so I like have been asking them to do this. They won't do it. But also too, I think that it is crazy because they could do something like, for example, the FIA, which is the international governing body that runs Formula One, they about 5 to 10 years ago, I don't remember the exact date, but they were like, oh my God, we have all of these archival materials, all of these old documents, like for Formula One, and not even just Formula One, but like all of motorsports. And they were like, we need to make sure that all of this is digitized and kept safe, like in a facility. So they bought a facility. I've spoken to the lady who runs the archives. She's amazing. But she was like, yeah, we had over 100 kilos of paper, just of document from motorsports. And so we're going through it now and we're digitizing it. And I would love for FIDE to do something like that. Do I think it's going to happen soon? No.
Yeah, that's very ambitious, I guess. No one wants to do administrative work, right? No one wants to do filing, basically. Like,
I
if
love
you ever worked an
filing.
office job, you know that people avoid filing.
That's so true. But I love filing. And I, well, I love filing in the sense of doing like archival work because I used to work in an archive in uni. And so, like, I know how to do all this work. I know how important it is. But also at the same time, it's just like one person can't do it. Like, I'd need a team because it's a lot of stuff. He told me yesterday that he has over 90 kilos worth of like memorabilia and stuff related to FIDE's administration and everything.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's like, yeah, that's so much. Are you allowed to tell us that? This isn't like the meeting isn't like confidential.
No, I mean, like, anyone can join the historical, because we're not a commission in FIDE.
Oh, okay.
Like, it's a committee. So anyone can join the committee if they want to be a member and are interested.
Okay.
If you're a woman in history who likes also chess history, like, please let me know, because then you can join the committee. But also, like, our meetings are recorded, and, like, I think it's fine. If I get in trouble for this, like, oh, well. Whatever.
I just wanted to pivot because the Oscars were two nights ago, and I am thrilled with most of the results. I just wanted to quickly recap this because we did talk about it in our last episode about our Oscars predictions. And I was so pleasantly surprised about how well Anora did because between them, they won 5 Oscars, including Best Actress for Mikey Madison. I was so, so happy. And I've seen a lot of backlash about it, and I've seen a lot of people who didn't seem to appreciate the film. But I actually watched another Sean Baker film last week. I watched The Florida Project for the first time, and I also really loved that, even though it covers very difficult topics. They're hard films to watch at points, but I loved it because I feel like he portrays these characters with such compassion, and it doesn't feel overly produced. And so I was just very happy. I felt like it was a win for cinema and artists for Anora to do so well at the Oscars. I don't know if you watched the Oscars, Amelia.
I didn't watch the Oscars, but I do know almost everyone who won. And I actually, for this podcast, started watching Anora last night. I have about an hour left, but I am also quite happy that Mikey Madison, is that her name? That she won Best Actress, because I think that this movie is very interesting, especially in terms of, like, when it comes to portraying sex workers. It's very clear that, you know, they took the input of sex workers and were really, she was very careful, like, with her character. I've seen a lot of interviews from her. And so.
Yes, I've seen a lot from the press tour as well.
Yeah, I'm at the part where this is a bit of a spoiler if you haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm at the part where they're looking for her Russian oligarch husband, Ivan. I honestly am just really sad that she's not getting her princess moment. Like, you know, I got really emotionally invested kind of in this idea that she was going to succeed and kind of become the wife of this Russian oligarch guy and, or guy's son. And, you know, I just think that the emotion that she's portraying through this character is so good. And also, I saw she's only 25.
Yeah. Yeah. She's very young to win Best Actress. This doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
Like, this really doesn't happen. And I totally agree. And there's this moment in the film. Well, I don't know about you, but I was rooting for her the whole film. I think she was very sympathetically portrayed. And I think rightfully so. And you do want her to get her princess moment. You want her to, if not be happy in the marriage, you want her to get something out of the marriage, because you just want her to succeed in life. And I think that, I don't want to spoil the ending of the film for you, so I won't say what happens.
It's okay, I already read the Wikipedia page.
Okay. Well, I think that it's actually very important that we're seeing a narrative portrayed where you don't have this man save her, you know? Because that's not very realistic. And I think that if you want to portray, like, real professions and real people in a sympathetic way, you can't change their narratives to suit your film project, basically. Because how many exotic dancers get to marry Russian oligarchs? Like, you know, this is it's already kind of an unrealistic story. And so the fact that she doesn't end up with him makes sense, I think, for me. And it feels more liberating for her as a character, because you know that if she did end up married to Ivan, she would be living underneath him, like, in sense of, So yeah, I think I really loved this, and I really loved the way that the film was made. I've seen a lot from the press tour, like I said, you know, like the whole first scene, basically, where you're in the strip club, like was essentially unscripted. She really embodied the character. Mm-hmm. She thought about everything from like the shoes she's wearing being so high yet so difficult to walk in, that she's given this height and grandeur yet she's so like she would be so quick to fall because they're so unstable. Mm-hmm. And like everything has
meaning,
like everything is so crafted. And then I saw this tweet this morning which was comparing Anora, the screenplay, and A Real Pain, and I watched both films and I loved both films, and basically the point of the tweet was to show how much better the screenplay was for A Real Pain than it was for Anora. And I think that it just totally missed the point of Anora, and if you can't find like the humanity and the compassion in a film like Anora, then it just shows me that you need to really like widen your horizons, because mm-hmm. of course A Real Pain is a very emotive film. It's about, you know, two cousins who go on a, they call it in the film, they call it a Holocaust tour. Basically they go to Poland and they do a tour of some of the major sites from World War II, and they have a familial tie to that. And so it's very moving in that way. But I don't think that that takes away from the fact that Anora is also like a very beautifully crafted film. And I hate when people pit two pieces of art against each other because they're so different as well.
I haven't seen A Real Pain yet, but I agree. I think Anora too, like, one thing you have to also understand is that this was a choice that they made. I mean, they're also an independent film, so they didn't have the budget to mm-hmm. do a lot, but like they filmed Anora without an intimacy coordinator, which when you watch the film, the confidence that Mikey Madison has, I do not have. Like, it is insane that they filmed this without an intimacy coordinator. And like, it just really goes to show, I think, the fact that she always mentions, you know, I felt very safe on set. It was a very comfortable mm-hmm. environment. I never felt in any way like, you know, I needed an intimacy coordinator. And
mm-hmm.
so I think it really goes to show, because I think Jesse Eisenberg, is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jesse, the person who wrote and starred in A Real Pain.
Yeah. I think Jesse Eisenberg and Sean Baker as directors, you can tell that they really care about their characters and the actors themselves to create an environment where they can make movies like this. And so I totally agree. The only thing I am sad about when it comes to the Oscars is that Adrien Brody won Best Actor for The Brutalist. I 100% think it should have either gone to Timmy or to the the guy that played, what's his name? He played Donald Trump in The Apprentice movie.
Oh, you know what? I really wanted to see that film, but I haven't seen it. I think I missed the window and it was showing here in France, mm-hmm. and I still haven't seen it, but I really want to see it. I also thought that Coleman Domingo in Sing Sing was really amazing and did a really moving performance, so I'd really recommend Sing Sing for anyone who hasn't seen it yet. I saw a lot of people saying that Demi Moore was robbed and that Mikey Madison winning Best Actress was like the plot of The Substance coming to fruition. And I thought that this like couldn't be more inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to think about the fact that like it's difficult even to say that Demi Moore is the leading role in The Substance because she shares her screen time so much with Margaret Qualley that they feel like they both led that film.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't actually say that one of them was better in the film than the other. I thought they were both very good. And I thought that The Substance was good, but I didn't think it was as good as almost any of the other films I saw nominated. But yeah, I was happy about this. And I saw something very interesting about the Oscars, actually, which was about the best foreign feature film category, mm-hmm. and which is that countries have to nominate films to put forward for this. And so if a film is made in your country, that is kind of critical of your country. Of course, your country will never nominate that film. So I think there was a film nominated by Germany, which is an Iranian film, which is The Seeds of an Ancient Fig. Sorry, I'm trying to translate it because I saw it with the French title, but I'm pretty sure that's the English title. And it's a film set in Iran with Iranian actors, Iranian director, set under the regime, critical of the regime. they were all basically wanted by the government. They had to flee to Germany, and Germany put forward this film for some awards. Obviously, the best foreign feature film was won by I'm Still Here, which is a great film, Brazilian film. But it made me really think a lot about the way that films are even nominated and get to the point of being shown, because the film that won Best Documentary, I think it's called No Other Land, was a collaboration between Israel and Palestine. And this doesn't have distribution rights in the US for, you know, reasons that are very clearly implied. And I think that we should be very critical of the media that we consume, how it gets to us. And like, the fact is that there isn't just this choice of like four films, right? Mm-hmm. There are so many other films, and you should always be wondering why these are the ones presented to you to watch.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, to like, I used to work in the film industry, I used to study film, and I used to like want to be a documentary filmmaker. And with that, one of the reasons why I don't anymore is because I became quite disillusioned by the fact that, you know, the industry is really kind of controlled by people who, you know, choose essentially what films go out and what films don't. And I remember, because I went to Venice Film Festival a few years ago, and there it's obviously a film festival, so people can submit stuff. And I saw a movie, it was called Princess. It was about Nigerian sex workers in Italy, I believe. And it was either Italy or France. And this movie, I remember it frame by frame, like until this day. It was so beautifully made. And the story, I would say, honestly, is quite similar to Anora, in that like, mm-hmm. it is about a sex worker who falls in love with one of her clients and, mm-hmm. you know, like wants to move in with him and so on and so forth. But, you know, that movie, it was made independently. The main star, she is a Black woman from Africa. And, you know, I can honestly say that, like, artistically, I think Anora visually is a bit more beautiful. Like, Princess was a bit more raw. But, you know, we need to think critically, like you said, about, okay, Anora stars a white actress, you know, as a sex worker in the US, whereas Princess stars a Black sex worker, and that's a minority, like in a European country. And like, what do these two stories tell us kind of about not only the film industry, but like the world that we live in and what stories we pay attention to? So I totally agree.
Yeah, and I think that looking at those two films side by side, I haven't seen Princess, but it raises very interesting questions about agency and independence and like even the sex industry itself, because there is this big issue of immigrants coming to Europe, specifically women coming to Europe, and then being trafficked, sex trafficked. So this is probably tied to Princess, because these stories are real and they do happen, especially in like the south of Italy, or like honestly anywhere coming into Europe, people are taken advantage of. And yeah, I mean, in Anora, obviously Mikey Madison's character, she is not wealthy, but she does have, she has her agency. She's very independent. She can get out at any time if she wants to, which is a really big privilege. And it's not one that like a lot of sex workers have. And I think that representation for this industry anyway is lacking, but I'm glad that we're seeing more of it now. And I think that all of the stories, whether they're to do with white women or minorities, they're all worth telling. And I think so, I would just like to see more of them and to see them being done well.
Yeah, totally agree. Well, I think this is a good place to end our second podcast.
I was just going to say, we didn't mention the fact that this is video.
Oh, true.
So if you're listening on Spotify and you've gotten all the way through, you're going to be so mad, because this is actually a video podcast now, and you're going to see this with video. So we should have mentioned that at the beginning. But hopefully we will now be doing video pods every week. We thought that it would really bring the podcast to life more, and it's something we wanted to do from the beginning.
Yeah, I totally agree. So much so, I bought a new camera for this. So, guys, please just
Thank
let
you.
our podcast pop off so that I can get reimbursed for this camera.
I do have an announcement, but maybe we can talk about it next time.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine too. And then people will come back, so they'll be like, oh my God, what was the announcement? You know?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. I know that we have spoken about a lot of different issues. Some of them were maybe a bit more sensitive than others. So, yeah, we're open to feedback, so don't feel afraid to reach out. And we are looking forward to seeing you in our next episode, which will be episode 3 already of The Middle Game.
Yeah. See you guys soon. Bye.
Bye, guys.